Welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio. I'm Carmen LaSalle. On November 10th, 2005, Media Alliance, Global Exchange, Free Press, Independent World Television, the New College Media Studies Program, the Ruth Group, and others welcomed John Nichols and Robert McChesney in celebration of the release of their new book, Tragedy and Farce: How the Media Sell Wars, Spin Elections, and Destroy Democracy. On a personal note, I was the lucky one assigned to pick Nichols and McChesney up at SFO. When they got into their car, they noticed my bumper sticker, Orwell was an optimist. During the Q&A session of their talk, someone asked about the so-called free speech zones, the places where the police allow protesters to congregate and express themselves during international gatherings, such as the WTO talks. These zones are miles away from the meetings, so none of the participants ever see any dissension. The irony of calling them free speech zones wasn't lost on Nichols or McChesney. John Nichols said, "Well, the woman who picked us up at the airport has a bumper sticker, Orwell was an optimist. And I think this kind of doublespeak proves it." So my bumper sticker became part of the talk. This event was located in the Unitarian Universalist Church in San Francisco. The capacity crowd heard Nichols and McChesney speak and watched a video about the start of Independent World Television. IWT will be a nonprofit broadcast service financed by viewers across the globe, independent of corporate or government funding and commercial advertising. Also, Andrea Buffa, the Communications Director of Global Exchange, and Jeff Perlstein, the Executive Director of Media Alliance, spoke about their organizations and the need for media activism. On this recording, you will hear a brief introductions by Andrea and Jeff, followed by John Nichols and Robert McChesney. At the end, I'll relist the sponsors with their websites for you to check out. The first speaker is Andrea Buffa of Global Exchange.
Global Exchange is a human rights organization. We're working on environmental issues, peace and justice issues, fair trade, sustainability. And we're not necessarily a media activist group per se, but I think we realize, and hopefully more and more nonprofits and advocacy groups realize, that we all have to be media activists. Because whether the issue that's really closest to our heart is the war in Iraq, or homelessness, or police brutality, any of the issues that we care about, if the media isn't covering our issues, if they're not covering our voices and our perspectives, if they're stereotyping us, it's affecting our campaigns. People aren't finding out what we're doing, and we're not going to be able to win. So thanks so much for being here. I'm going to bring up Jeff Perlstein from Media Alliance. Probably the longest-lasting media activist group in the country. Their 30-year anniversary is coming up this year. Jeff Perlstein.
So this is a great moment to segue, because as Andrea mentioned when she kicked it off here, clearly we're all here because we recognize there's a deep crisis in our media system. But there's two key pieces that are complementary and mutually reinforcing if we're going to really make some change. One is producing independent media, that is the media that we want, right? The other piece is transforming the current media system, holding corporations accountable, holding our government accountable, and changing policy. So these two pieces need to be happening at the same time. They're mutually reinforcing, they build each other. And so now we're segueing from the independent media piece of the program into the media reform, media activism, media justice, media democracy piece of the program. So you've heard a bit from Bob McChesney. You're going to hear more from him in a minute. I'm going to introduce his co-conspirator and co-author. The actual occasion that they're here tonight is part of a book tour, as you heard them mention. That book is Tragedy and Farce: How the American Media Sell Wars, Spin Elections, and Destroy Democracy. And they'll be signing this book after the talk this evening. So besides being the co-author of this rockin' new book, which actually has illustrations by Tom Tomorrow and a foreword by Tim Robbins, so make sure to pick it up. Besides being the co-founder of Free Press along with Bob, John is also the Nation Magazine's DC correspondent. He also is the author of Jews for Buchanan. Yeah, he doesn't have much of a sense of humor, which you'll get a sense of how little sense of humor he has. And he also is the proud father of Whitman Genevieve, who couldn't be here tonight. She's back in Madison, right? But on a personal note, I just want to say too, when I started at Media Alliance 4 years ago, the very first public event that we did was actually right here in this room with John Nichols. And it was a great crowd. And I have to say, it was a real highlight of the first couple months for me because of his generosity of spirit, but also his fierce intellect and great sense of humor. So I'm sure you'll enjoy his presentation. And John Nichols, please welcome him.
I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. This is the first day of my adult lifetime when Judith Miller didn't work for the New York Times. I see reason for celebration. People ask me, you know, is there progress or is things getting better? You know, let me tell you, just the notion that at least for this day, Judith Miller cannot call herself a working journalist. We have made huge progress. And I want to explain to you why Judith Miller was let go, because many people think, well, it might have been the fact that, you know, she got the Iraq war wrong. But that's unfortunately not it. The interesting thing was that they were checking over the salary records, and they realized that for the last 28 years, they've been paying her as a journalist, when in fact she's been working as a stenographer. And if you doubt that, I invite you to go back and look at Judith Miller's coverage of weapons of mass destruction before the war began, because there is no other way to describe what Judith Miller did for Ahmad Chalabi, who amusingly enough is trotting around Washington today, meeting with Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and his fellow unindicted co-conspirators. It was stenography. Chalabi would say something, Judith Miller would write it, and it would appear on the front page of the New York Times. Why did that matter? Because the New York Times is supposed to be the liberal opposition newspaper. And so, if we have a president who is willing to lie about weapons of mass destruction, and a vice president who, when he opens his mouth, is either breathing or lying, and a Congress where there is virtually no opposition party, we look to the press. And of course you're not going to tune in Fox and say, well, I really want to figure this WMD thing out. I think maybe I'll check out O'Reilly and see if he's got its finger on the pulse. You don't go to Limbaugh. That doesn't make any sense. You go to the New York Times because they don't like Bush, right? I mean, everybody knows. It's an opposition paper. That's the bottom line truth. And besides, we all read the New York Times. Some of us don't admit it. But, you know, it's like we accept it for the paper of record. And there on the front page of the New York Times, day after day after day, is an echo of the Bush administration's lies. In fact, an amplification. Things the president was not willing to say. He's like, you know, I'll say a lot, but that stuff's crazy. No, it goes on the front page of the New York Times. And so liberal thinking, rational Americans say, you know, gee, maybe it really is. Maybe there really is something there. Because the New York Times, I mean, they got editors and stuff like that. All right? So they check these things out. Judith Miller, she won the Pulitzer Prize. She's a super journalist. So it's got to be okay. I will argue today, and I will argue to the end of my life, that Judith Miller did more to start the war in Iraq than George Bush or Dick Cheney. Because George Bush and Dick Cheney are professional politicians. It is their job to lie. They happen to be better at it than most. But it is the job of the media in a democracy to catch the lies and to tell the people about them. When the so-called liberal opposition newspaper fails to do so, the entire system collapses. And that is the point of our book, Tragedy and Farce. We argue that we have reached the point of collapse, of tragedy and farce, and I'll explain the quote and the phrase itself in a moment. But before I go into the remarks, I do want to do just a couple of introductory things here. First off, I want to echo what's been said about independent world television. Now, the fact of the matter is, I'm not going to tell you where to create your alternative media. You go where you want to go. You create what you want to create. That is how we are going to make this change happen. But I will tell you that if you're looking for a vehicle to go to the belly of the beast, to go into television, which is where most people do get their information, for better or worse, what Paul Jay and the IWT team have done goes further than what anyone else has done. It is a worthy project to explore and learn more about. Two, if you are not already a member of Media Alliance, paying your dues, become a member and pay the dues. When we go around the country, people say, how are we going to fix this damn thing? Again and again, we point to San Francisco. We say there is one organization that is already doing the work. It is Media Alliance. And the fact of the matter is, if we had such an organization in every town in this country, we would already be winning the fight. There is simply no question. If you're not a member of Media Alliance, join, pay your dues. Finally, I'm very honored to have this event co-sponsored by Global Exchange. I have had the honor of joining Medea Benjamin in a number of arrests. And I have seen Medea Benjamin and other global exchangers do the one thing that most prestigious functional groups don't do, and that is get out on the front lines in a place like Seattle and throw themselves between the cops and the kids. The fact of the matter is, Global Exchange is the model for what an activist group ought to be. This is a group that educates. This is a group that challenges. It does all the things an activist group should do, but they also go into the streets and take the risks that other groups don't. Global Exchange, headquartered here in San Francisco, if you are not associated with it, if you're not working with it, do more. It is an essential group. And every issue that I have cared about over the last 10 years, when I get there to cover it, I always find that Medea and the rest of the Global Exchange folks are already there. They're the only group about which I can say that, a fantastic organization. I commend them to you, and I'm very glad to have tonight co-sponsored by them. Now, tragedy and farce. Well, the bottom line is this. The question that you always ask yourself, if you are an optimist, and Bob and I are optimists, is how do you make a democracy work? Because if you're an optimist, you believe that your fellow citizens, given the right tools, would do the right thing, that they would feed the poor, that they would eliminate inequality, that they would stop illegal and immoral wars. If you believe that, and I do believe that, as somebody who's covered politics in this country for the better part of 25 years, then you have to say, well, what's wrong with the system? Why can't our fellow citizens do that? Why don't we have a democracy and a government in this country that is reflective of our decency? Well, the answer is pretty simple. It's not an easy one. There's a lot of ways to fix democracy. First off, starting gate equality. You eliminate the grotesque economic inequalities in a society so that everybody can actually at least have that few minutes to participate because they're not scraping to get by. You eliminate the racial inequalities, the sexual inequalities, the sexual orientation inequalities so that people can come to the table as full citizens, not pushed away and made second class. It's a first step. Maybe campaign finance reform. We make it possible for both sides in a fight to be heard. Or maybe we even imagine that there might be more than both sides, that there might be multiple parties. Our friend Stephen Hill is here tonight. He's written more than probably anybody in the country about the struggle to have a real multi-party democracy, an IRV, and other tools that make it work. Well, fundamental changes, healthy ones. San Francisco in the lead. Maybe we even do electoral reform, right? Maybe we come up with a crazy concept like we actually count every ballot. And the person who wins the election gets to be president. Crazy concepts like that, that in other countries have actually been proven to work. It's a lot of good reforms we can do. But when we think about reform, we generally come back, at least Bob and I do, to where the founders started. And remember, the founders were pretty lucky people, Jefferson, Madison, all that. They were imperfect. They made a lot of mistakes. But they had the wonderful opportunity to do something most of us don't get to do, which is think, well, if I was going to create a country, how would I make it work? How would I make it function? And what the founders recognized is, yeah, there's all these structural tools, all these things you can do. But if you are going to have a democracy, the first and foremost thing that you do is get information to the people. Provide a system that assures that the people can get the information they need to act as citizens in that democracy. A simple construct. Couple minor requirements. One, that information cannot come from those who are in power. Because if those who are in power provide the information, it will be information provided with the purpose of perpetuating their power. So the government can't run the media. The economic elites can't run the media. Because if they do, you will never have change. It is impossible. The founders understood that. That's why the freedom of the press protection is in the First Amendment to the Constitution. It is not there to protect the press. If you go back and read the founding documents, the founding statements, they don't say, oh yeah, we want to really help Rupert Murdoch to get a lot of power 2 centuries down the road. No, what they say is, you need a free press to make a functioning democracy because we, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, we don't trust ourselves. We're the leaders of this whole operation, but we know even we are imperfect, and if we have power and we are not questioned and we are not challenged, we will become corrupted. We will destroy the experiment. Jefferson was brilliant in this regard. He used to, after he became president of the United States, meet with leaders from around the world. He was considered one of the great intellectuals. It's often said if you put all the presidents in a room and Jefferson walked out, half the IQ points would go with him. Currently, of course, if you put him and Bush in the room, all the IQ points would leave at that point. But Jefferson loved to teach by example. He used to, in his office, he had an inner office, an outer office, he would take the newspapers from around the country, small country, pile them up. And if a foreign leader was coming, someone from Russia or from Denmark, someplace else in the world, was coming to visit him, he would go out, sneak out, and arrange the newspapers. He would put the most critical papers on top, the ones that called him an atheist, which he sort of was, ones that said he had a slave mistress and black children. You know, you think, oh, this is a revelation we just found out. They wrote about it back in 1800. He put all the critical papers on top, and then the foreign visitors would come and visit, and his assistant would come in and say, Mr. Jefferson, are you ready to meet with the Russian delegation? He said, no, I'm very busy. They'll have to wait out in the outer room for a few minutes. And then he would sit in his office, as they read through the papers. Finally, they would be ushered in. And their first thing they would say to him is, Mr. Jefferson, how can you allow such things to be written about you? It's scandalous. They're calling you these horrible things. And Jefferson, always looking for the teaching moment, would say, ah, you see, in our country, we believe that the leader must always be challenged and questioned. And the only way that will happen is if you have a free press and all those different voices owned by different people, run by different people, different critiques, different ideas, because we have faith in the people. And ultimately, the truth will come out of that cacophony. You need to go back to your country and have a free press. Jefferson fought the election of 1800. On that principle of freedom of the press. John Adams, now made into a hero by some rather average historians, he was a rotund royalist. He was not a good guy. And Adams tried to shut down the press. He tried to limit criticism of the president. Jefferson ran against him on the very principle that you had to have it. But Jefferson wasn't the great one. The great one, who I've lost my book here, so I'll have to make the quote up. That's okay. The really great guy was Madison. Madison is the kind of guy who would go back and check the door twice to make sure it was locked. James Madison absolutely feared for the experiment. He feared one thing above all else. Go back and read Madison's quotes about war. He was terrified. He said that war is the biggest danger to democracy, perpetual war the greatest danger, because it feeds the germs of all other dangers. And a country that is forever at war will lose all of its freedoms, because war is the tool by which the executive accumulates power into himself. Ironic, is it not? But the other thing he worried about most was media. And Jefferson said that without a free and independent media, owned diversely, different voices, and without the assurance that citizens would have access to a variety of information, a variety of ideas, that the American experiment would degenerate into tragedy or farce or both. We come to you tonight to suggest that we have reached the Madisonian moment, and that recent experience is the confirmation, not for you, the activists of San Francisco who are willing to come out on a relatively rainy or cold night and sit in a church hall for a couple hours and talk about these issues. You could go to virtually any thinking American and confront them with the realities of our moment, and they would agree it is the Madisonian moment. Consider the two great tests of any media system in a democracy. How does it inform the citizens about the question of whether we should go to war, whether children should die in our name? Number one. And how do we choose our leaders? How do we choose those who have the power to take this country to war, to make the fundamental decisions about all of our lives? War and elections, the two things that media, above all else, has to get right. You know, the weather doesn't matter that much. The sports scores don't matter that much. The O.J. Simpson trial really didn't matter that much. The Natalie Holloway missing teenager in Aruba doesn't matter that much. Matters to her family. I care. I'm sympathetic. But what matters in a democracy is, do you have the information to decide whether we should send our children to their deaths? Do you have the information to decide who you will give the power of the purse, the power of the treasury, the power to make the fundamental decisions about our lives? Two simple tests in the last few years. War in Iraq. Of course, everything started on September 11th. For most of us, in reality, if we read Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of the Treasury's book, for Dick Cheney, it started on January 20th, 2001, with the initial cabinet meetings where they started talking about the need to do something about Iraq. But we had, on September 11th, an incredible day, a horrible day. Americans shocked that someone would hate us so much that they would fly planes into two of our tallest buildings in the Pentagon. Ironic that the choices would be center of American economic power, center of American military power. Why would anybody hate us for how we use economic and military power? That question could actually have been considered wrong-minded or absurd speaks volumes about a dysfunctional media. It is the simple, fundamental, basic question of the moment. But the interesting thing is that when that occurred, most Americans knew nothing about Al-Qaeda. They knew nothing about Islamic fundamentalist militancy. They knew nothing about Afghanistan. But it wasn't true in the rest of the world. You know, after September 11th, the first thing that, once they had pretty well established, they thought, well, it's Al-Qaeda was responsible for this. Osama bin Laden had some role in this. They're like, well, how do we get the guy? How do we track him down? Well, we're going to have to invade Afghanistan and replace the government, you know, and then we're going to go find him there, right? Well, you know, if they'd read the British press, it would have been easier. Because, of course, The Telegraph, a conservative newspaper in London, shortly after September 11th, published a report from their reporter on the ground in Afghanistan of Osama bin Laden's going away party. Live reportage of the going away party. Osama on a white horse. He's very theatrical, waving as the crowd cheers. Not making this stuff up. I wish I could. I'm not this good to make this stuff up. And of course, the French weren't very surprised. Every major French publication had reporters on the ground in Afghanistan covering the destruction of the Buddhist statues at Bamiyan, the horrific treatment of the women where they were executed on Friday afternoon as entertainment in the soccer stadiums, the rise of the Northern Alliance. Fascinating, relevant, exciting stories about things happening in the world. The French were not surprised. Many people around the world were not surprised, but Americans were. Imagine if in the summer of 2001, the American press had had the same level of coverage of Afghanistan and recognized the same rising tensions, same developments as the French press did, or much of the rest of the international press did, might it have been possible that we would have anticipated that something was amiss? Might even a doltish son of privilege, while on vacation in Texas, have looked at the report that said Osama bin Laden intends to attack in the United States and said, gee, you know, there might be something to this. Perhaps we ought to beef up security. But no, the media, again, freedom of the press not to protect the media, but to force the leaders to do right, to be accountable, to be aware. The media not pressuring, not paying attention. The two big stories of the summer of 2001. First story, Gary Condit's sex life, congressman from California, one of your own. Gary, we know more about Gary Condit's sex life than I know about my own. The guy apparently had handcuffs and things like this. Very exciting. Dated stewardesses. A lot of big stuff going on. Day in, day out, we followed Gary Condit's sex life as it became more and more evident to us that he was maybe not the guy we'd want our daughters to date. The other big story of the summer of 2001, shark attacks off Florida. Go back and look at the video. All the networks. So this isn't just Fox. It's not just, you know, the cartoon channel. This is CNN and, well, of course, cartoon channel, you know. But anyway, bottom line, coverage of shark attacks. And you know what we learned at the end of 2001, unnoted by most people? There were no more shark attacks in Florida in 2001 than there had been in 2000 or 1999. It was just a fun, easy story to cover. Doesn't cost much money. You go down and film the beach in Florida, and you say, well, there's probably somebody's getting bit by a shark today. Shark attacks Gary Condit, nothing about the world. September 11th comes. We're a blank slate. Our government, because our media has not brought us into the discourse, made us a part of this looking at the world, informed us with the information that we need, because they made convenient commercial decisions to cover sex and shark attacks, to not set up bureaus in Africa or Afghanistan or other places around the world, left us completely vulnerable to a government that would lie to us. They made possible the lies, and they accelerated them. They amplified them. I'm not going to go into all the details of what happened before the war because you're mad about it. I know that. You should be. Just look at the fairness and accuracy in reporting study of the debate on television news before the war in Iraq. A ratio in those final weeks of more than 90-1 pro-war guests versus anti-war guests. Some networks literally not putting an anti-war guest on in the entire final period before the war began. The range of debate from extending from the general who said, let's attack from the north, to the general who said, let's attack from the south. And the lack of questioning, so unimaginably horrific, that 2 days before the war began, Dick Cheney, unable to open his mouth without breathing or lying, appeared on Meet the Press and said, we will be greeted as liberators. Tonight, in America, more than 2,000 mothers will walk down the hall in their home, and they will go to a room where a son or a daughter that they nurtured from birth and about whom they had all of the wonderful dreams that any mother would have will look at that room and see an empty bed and know that that child will never come home. And that mother will also know that Dick Cheney said, your child will be greeted as a liberator. They will throw flowers in front of his or her feet. That child is dead today. And we can blame Dick Cheney, and I love blaming Dick Cheney for everything that's wrong. But we must also blame the reporter who sat across from Dick Cheney and did not say, Mr. Vice President, that's absurd. You are invading a sovereign country. There will be people there who object. Our media failed us in the most fundamental level. And the real failure didn't come before the war. The real failure came once the war began, because we embedded our journalists. When you embed a journalist, he sees what's happening just in front of him. We never created a narrative. The opposition, the insurgency, became a shock to Americans, even to members of Congress, because all they'd seen is, you know, just through the lens of the American troops, everything going actually rather well. Yeah, they'd kill a carload of civilians now and again. But, you know, basically, just rolling through. We got no narrative. We got no reality. And when it actually began to sink in, the American people were horrified. More than 60% of Americans now say the war was a mistake. More than 50% now say it's time to start figuring out how to get out. They would have said that before if they had been given the information when they needed it. And what did our media tell us about the anti-war movement? On the Friday after the war began, my wife and I came home to our little place in Madison, Wisconsin, and as good Wisconsinites, we sat down to watch television. That's what you do in Wisconsin in the winter at night. And we turned on CNN, the cable news network, not Fox. We didn't listen to Rush Limbaugh. Remember, if Fox and Rush Limbaugh did not exist, we'd still be at war in Iraq. Nothing would be different. They're bad. We can really pick on them. We really hate them. It's the media system. It's the whole structure that is rotten, not those two bad apples. We turn on the television set, and there's Aaron Brown, CNN's very serious newsman. You know he's serious because he's one of those guys, he's now been let go, but he's one of those guys who, when he's really going to tell you something important, he takes his glasses off. Aaron Brown is on, and he's warning us. And, you know, we're news junkies, so we know when something big's going to happen. He's warning, he says, we're going to show you a scene that's going to really trouble you. Some people are going to be very bothered by this. It's going to be very unsettling to some of our viewers. But we feel we have to show you this because we're a news network. We show you all the stuff that's going on, so we have to show you this. So then they go to a live shot after all this warning. Mary and I are, you know, on edge. What could it be? It's a helicopter shot from above of a peaceful anti-war demonstration in the streets of Chicago. People with signs saying, thou shalt not kill, mostly from religious groups. And the helicopter hovered over. They seemed to be moving through the streets. They come back to CNN. About 5 minutes later, Aaron Brown gets all hyped up. You know it's something important's coming because he touches his ear. Okay, we're going to go straight to Baghdad. We've got some new fresh video from there. And we went to Baghdad, and you saw bombs popping, blowing up, you know, all the signs. Bombs falling on the homes of people. Blowing them up, killing them. And so I thought to myself, well, what if the alien arrived tonight? As good Wisconsinites, we would greet him as we do any stranger. We would say, come on over to the house. Let's have some pizza, maybe some beer, and we'll watch TV. So the alien settles in. We turn on CNN. We watch the report I've just described. The alien hustles out, back in the capsule, back to the planet. And they say, ugh. You know, what is this Earth like? He says, it's a very strange place. I watched a little of their communication system. I watched how they communicate. I said, well, what did you learn? He says, well, they seem to be extremely troubled by people who say, thou shalt not kill, but they have no problem with killing. That's what our media has made us. We live in that. We are boiling in that stew, and it has screwed us up terribly. Tragedy. The war in Iraq is a tragedy. What about the farce? Madison said we get a farce. Well, let's take a look at the election of 2004. An election that took place in which the unelected president, and remember, in any democracy in the world, the guy who gets the lesser number of votes doesn't become president, right? So the unelected president, who also, in fact, with the help of his brother and the dim-witted Catherine Harris, not so dim-witted Catherine Harris, stole the state of Florida. You know, if this is Zimbabwe, we'd talk about some people stealing one region and then somehow using their power over the courts to, and we'd cut off their foreign aid, right? So this guy's running for re-election or election the first time. That's a big deal in and of itself. You know, you ought to pay a little attention to that. But also, it's in a time of war. The war's going badly. Members of his own administration are exposing that the war was based on lies. The economy's not doing so good. The trade policies aren't so functional. We've got all sorts of other problems in the country. Things aren't going so well, right? So what was the big issue of 2004? Go ahead, throw it out. You're smart San Franciscans. Thank you. What a smart young woman. Absolutely. You were watching the news. And, you know, did anybody here, if you weren't in the military, had you ever heard of a Swift boat before 2004? I mean, I just figured a boat is swift if you turn the motor on. But no, there's an actual Swift boat. So 2004, the Swift boat, right? You know, we get the whole damn thing. I was watching MSNBC, which is an actual credible news channel. They got news in their name, I think. And so I'm watching the thing, and they're talking about, there's a debate, and there's like two people on debating. One, a guy who had served with Kerry, and one, a guy who hadn't served with Kerry, but knew a lot. And the guy who hadn't served with Kerry was saying, and he turned the boat to the left when the fight was to the right over there. And he went the wrong way because he's a coward. And the guy who's with him says, no, he turned the boat to the right. You know, really, you know. And they're like debating, no, I've seen the records. He turned it. They were debating how the guy turned on a river in 1969. I don't want to hear a debate about what I did in 1969 or even 79. I was a kid. I made mistakes. But the bottom line is we knew everything about that. And in fairness, we knew just about everything about the fact that George Bush's dad got him out of the draft. What a shocking thing. A rich guy got his kid out of the draft. So we knew a lot about what these people did in 1969. We knew virtually nothing about what they would do in 2005. We had the emptiest, most vapid, most unchallenging, most dysfunctional discourse and debate that you could possibly have. In the midst of war, we didn't even have an anti-war candidate of viability in the fall election. There was no fight there. John Kerry's a better guy. He would be a better president. I guarantee you that. But the bottom line is, this was an empty election. It was the election that Karl Rove and George Bush wanted. They wanted it to be about fear, about national security, about that whole Iraq, Afghanistan thing. And they got it. The majority of people who voted to reelect George W. Bush, according to polling, believed that they were reelecting. Well, first off, they believe they were reelecting an environmentalist. It's one of my favorite things. They think Bush is a big environmentalist because he like moves brush down in Texas. But they believe two things. They believe two things. That they were reelecting a man who was fighting a war against a country or in a country where weapons of mass destruction that threatened the United States had been discovered. And they believed that they were backing a man who had invaded a country and removed a leader who had conspired with Osama bin Laden to create the September 11th attacks on the United States. The majority of people who reelected George Bush believed weapons of mass destruction were found and that Saddam was tied to Osama bin Laden. That is not an indictment of Karl Rove or George Bush. And it is certainly not an indictment of the working Americans who, you know, you work at Wendy's in the morning, you work at McDonald's in the afternoon, you rush off to the polls, you're busy, you're raising a kid. That is an indictment of a media system, a whole media structure that allows such fundamental lies and inaccuracy to get through and to go unchallenged. And they did. And the bottom line is, that is a farce. An election in which people vote on fundamental inaccuracy, fundamental misinformation, is a farce. Madison, tragedy or farce or both. We have reached the Madisonian moment. This is it. You're living in it. And the question we must ask ourselves is, what are we going to do about it? And that's the end of my part of this conversation.
You have been listening to part one of San Francisco Liberation Radio's recording of John Nichols and Robert McChesney speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Church in San Francisco, California on November 10th, 2005. In part two, you'll hear Robert McChesney, professor of journalism at the University of Illinois in Champaign, explain the development of journalism in America during the 20th century. He ends his speech with a call to action. Citizens must not allow the corporate structure or the government to deprive them of real information in order for democracy to succeed in the USA. This program was sponsored by Media Alliance, a 29-year-old media resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Their mission is excellence, ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media in the interests of peace, justice, and social responsibility. Media Alliance website is www.media-alliance.org. The talk was also sponsored by Global Exchange, a membership-based international human rights organization dedicated to promoting social, economic, and environmental justice around the world. Global Exchange website, www.globalexchange.org. And another sponsor was Independent World Television. IWT will be a nonprofit broadcast service financed by viewers across the globe. Informed by a commitment to social justice and respecting diversity of opinion, IWT News Nightly will focus on news other media ignore and suppress, and on individuals and groups that are transforming the world. Website, www.iwtnews.com. The other sponsors were New College of California, www.newcollege.edu, and The Ruth Group, www.theruthgroup.com. I hope you have enjoyed John Nichols' speech and will also download part two, Robert McChesney. Music is by Otmar Liebert and copyrighted under the Creative Commons copyright law. This is Carmen LaSalle for San Francisco Liberation Radio. Thank you for listening.